friends, and welcome to this edition of the Ames Tribune for Tuesday, July 28th. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Pretty Handicapped. And here is our first story. Story County sees 17 new COVID-19 cases. This story is written by Robbie Sequeira. There are 17 new COVID-19 cases in Story County, and no new deaths, state health officials reported on Monday morning. 11 county residents have died from the virus, according to state spokesperson Stephen Sullivan, spokesperson for Mary Greeley Medical Center and Story County Public Health. The individual who was reported Saturday to have died due to the illness was an elderly adult over the age of 80. At 10 o'clock in the morning on Monday, the county's case total sat at 1,046, up 17 from 10 o'clock on Saturday. Of those who have tested positive in the county, 711 residents have recovered from the virus, according to the state. Acura Healthcare of Ames, which was identified by the state as having an outbreak in early July, was listed as having a total of 49 positive cases as of 10 o'clock on Monday, which is two additional cases from Saturday's total. Of those who have tested positive in the facility, 15 have recovered from the virus, according to the Iowa's website. Acura Healthcare of Ames is the second facility in Story County to have a confirmed outbreak, according to reports from the state. A total of 11,460 people have been tested for COVID-19 in Story County as of Monday morning, according to state data, and the county was listed as testing at a 9.1 positivity rate. Across Iowa, after no new deaths from the virus were reported on Sunday, the state reported three more COVID-19 related deaths on Monday at 10 a.m. On Monday, the state was reporting that 829 COVID related deaths have occurred in Iowa. Additionally, Iowa reported a total of 469 new cases on Monday since the same time the day before, bringing the state's total number of positive tests to 42,485. In Iowa, of those who have been tested for the virus, 29,729 have recovered, according to information from the state. Our next story, the Hy-Vee begins handing out free masks. Amanda Pist, a Hy-Vee employee, began distributing a complimentary mask to customers at the Lincoln Center Hy-Vee store on Monday in Ames. The grocery chain announced this month that it would hand out 3 million masks, part of an initiative it labeled Mask It Up, Shut COVID Down. It's your choice. Our next story, Hickory Grove owner seeks financial assistance from the county for a court-ordered demolition. This story by Robbie Sequeira. Last July, the Iowa District Court ordered Peter Gillen, owner of Hickory Grove Mobile Home Park in Ames, to downsize the park from 38 to 34 homes by August 2020 after he was found in violation of the county's zoning ordinance. Gillen is now asking the Story County Board of Supervisors for financial assistance for the court-ordered demolition of four non-compliant mobile trailers, a matter the board will discuss today. Gillen has identified $12,300 in expenses that he would like the county to assist with related to the demolition, according to a county memo. He also identified $45,000 worth of legal expenses and a septic system upgrade, but county staff are unclear if he is asking for financial assistance for those expenses. The county staff's recommendation to the board is to deny Gillen's request. In November, the Tribune chronicled the legal battle between Gillen and the county, which started when the county filed a complaint against Gillen and Hickory Grove on August 23rd of 2018. When the Hickory Grove Mobile Home Park was developed in 1957 on 190th Avenue, north of Ames, It started out with 34 homes on the property and added two additional homes when the county's zoning ordinances went into effect in 1958. The mobile home park is located on land that is zoned for A1 agriculture, with agriculture protections and restrictions on non-agriculture development. On March 12, 2003, a letter to the code enforcement officer read that the park had been operating with 35 to 40 mobile homes over the years, and that while exceeding 40 lots would violate non-conforming use, excuse me, that the park could continue to operate with 35 to 40 lots if it was maintained properly. On May 16, 2018, the county's Zoning Board of Adjustment denied the variance requested by the company to increase the number of mobile homes from 30 to 40 and to replace the existing mobile homes, two of which would have been 2 feet wider than the ones that they were replacing. After the county filed its complaint in March 2019, the decision was reached by Story County District Court Judge James Malloy, which invited further dispute. Malloy found Gillen and the mobile home park not guilty on both counts, according to court records. The county would soon appeal that decision in July. The verdict, handed down by District Court Judge James A. McGillen, to reverse a trial court's decision in March and find Gillen and the mobile home park in violation of county zoning code, ordered Gillen to reduce the number of mobile homes at the park from 38 homes to 34 homes by August, or be found in contempt of court. McGillen, in his dissent, questioned whether the mobile home park's infrastructure could handle the increase in homes and residents, and whether the expansion was occurring in common areas previously used for the enjoyment of residents of the park. Our next story, Iowans worry rule changes could let wind developers seize private land. This story from Donnell Eller, who writes for the Des Moines Register. Gene Learberg worries that proposed changes to the state's rules for building wind and solar farms could let developers and big utilities grab part of his 310-acre farm and 40-acre timber lot for their renewable energy projects. If someone's a mile away and wants to build turbines up, that's their business, said Learberg, who lives near Hubbard in central Iowa. I think they're getting paid pretty well to do it, but I don't want them on or near my property. Learberg and hundreds of other Iowans have written the Iowa Utilities Board expressing concern that the proposed rules would give large companies pursuing renewable energy projects the power to take their land without their consent through a process called eminent domain. The companies, for their own reasons, also are wary of the change. The State Board, which has received about 550 public comments on the proposed rules, says Iowa law already gives developers access to eminent domain when energy projects are required to have a generating certificate. Large wind projects in Iowa so far have avoided using that requirement, but that would change under the proposal. Big wind projects would need state certificates, and critics say that process would prompt increased use of eminent domain. It's extremely upsetting to think that an energy company could step in, dig up my farm, and plant a wind turbine where I don't want one, said Mary Ellen Fisher, who owns farmland in Audubon County. Her family agreed to one turbine, but does not want any more. Some groups say it's unlikely renewable energy projects could qualify for eminent domain under Iowa law, but they back greater safeguards. The proposed rule changes would also shift decisions about whether wind and solar projects should be built from county supervisors to the three-person Iowa Utilities Board. The governor appoints the utilities board members, who require state Senate confirmation. The move comes at a time when some county leaders are imposing or considering restrictions or moratoriums on wind development. Jack Seward, a Washington County supervisor, says renewable energy project decisions need to be left to local government. An unelected board, 120 miles away from the project at hand, will not have the priorities most important to the people impacted and should not be able to have final authority for what goes on between neighbors and neighborhoods, Stewart wrote to the state board. Although the board says the change would streamline the approval process, the proposed rules also have failed to gain favor with big investor-owned utilities or wind energy developers. They're concerned the board's proposal would create unneeded regulations, increase renewable energy costs and delays, and hinder development and construction. Our next story, Iowa State University project named finalist in Rural Broadband Initiative. This story written by Kylie Wellendorf. A project led by Iowa State University is one of two finalists in a national competition to get a city-scale test bed that's aimed at studying how to bring down the cost of delivering broadband to rural communities. The Platforms for Advanced Wireless Research announced on Monday. If awarded, Iowa State University's project, titled ARA, Wireless Living Lab for Smart and Connected Rural Communities, would be the fourth such test bed in the United States, according to an Iowa State University news release. Hongwei Shang, a professor at Iowa State University's Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering, is leading the project for the university. The project has been planned to contribute to the United States' leadership in advanced wireless research and innovation, and to address the long-standing challenges in rural broadband, Zhang said in the release. The impact of the project would be widespread, according to W. Samuel Esterling, Iowa State University's Dean of Engineering. Iowa State and our partners are excited about this project developing better technologies to connect rural communities and accelerating broadband availability, Esterling said in the release. This will have a big impact and make it available more opportunities to connect families, schools, farms, municipalities, and others across rural America. The Iowa State University project and the other finalist, a project led by the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, will each get $300,000 from the National Science Foundation, which funds the Platforms for Advanced Wireless Research, towards platform development, work to boost the opportunities for success across multiple research paths, and to ensure that the team ultimately selected for the next platform in the PAWR program is positioned for an accelerated deployment process at the start of 2021, according to the release. Given the stiff national competition, the selection of ARA as one of the two finalists reflects the unique strengths of the wireless communication and networking research program in our department, Afaska Kojhar, chairperson of Electrical and Computer Engineering, said in the release. It also ideally serves the land-grant mission of Iowa State by leading the nation in the design and development of next-generation affordable wireless networks for rural communities. Cities across Iowa are increasingly focused on providing ubiquitous broadband to residents, with some municipalities like Cedar Falls owning their networks and treating the internet as a utility. Iowa Deputy Chief Technology Officer Matt Burns, his office created new state broadband availability map that in August 2019 showed about 60% of Iowa has access to broadband internet, with large chunks of Northwest, Northeast, and Southern Iowa without broadband access. Our next story, we asked three doctors, will you get the first COVID-19 vaccine that becomes available? This story comes to us from the Dallas Morning News. Vaccines usually take years to develop, but as the coronavirus pandemic stretches into its fifth month in the U.S., scientists and companies all over the world racing to find a cure to treat COVID-19 by next year. Testing has been in the works since January, and vaccines must go through at least 3 phases of human trials before being approved. According to the New York Times, 27 vaccines are in various stages of human trials. Many have argued that a vaccine will allow the economy to eventually rebound to pre-coronavirus levels. But some are concerned about the accelerated process and possible safety protocols that may be moved forward too quickly to meet the goal. We spoke to 3 Texas doctors about whether they would receive the first COVID-19 vaccine. Here's what you need to know. Will you get the first COVID-19 vaccine that becomes available? All 3 health experts said they would get the first COVID-19 vaccine, provided the data from the human trials is promising. Dr. Trish Pearl, Chief of Infectious Diseases at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center and an infectious disease specialist at Parkland Health and Hospital System, said she would feel comfortable with a vaccine that shows it has a strong immune response, both in a lab setting and in humans. They actually have several candidate vaccines right now, and they're generating an immune response. It's very evident to us, Pearl said. You form antibodies, which is what it's supposed to happen when you give it, when we give you a vaccine, she said. But that antibody needs to be what we call neutralizing. It needs to kill the virus. And that's the part of the puzzle that we need to solve right now, said Dr. Philip Huang, director of Dallas County Health and Human Services. He said he would feel comfortable getting the approved COVID-19 vaccine, but he added that the Centers for Disease Control will probably prioritize vaccine in certain groups, such as pregnant women and people over age 65. A similar approach was taken with the H1N1 vaccine used in the swine flu epidemic in 2009. People in high-risk groups or who frequently interact with people in high-risk groups should definitely get vaccinated, said Dr. Beth Kazanov, an internal medicine physician with North Texas Preferred Health Partners and 2021 president-elect of the Dallas County Medical Society. I think I would certainly get it, she said, adding that she would feel most comfortable with a vaccine that is approved by the Food and Drug Administration. I am in a high-risk group. I'm immunosuppressed, and my elderly father-in-law lives with me. I think I would encourage my teenagers that live in my house for us all to get it. Should the public be worried about the accelerated vaccine process? The experts said that while it is unprecedented for a vaccine to be created in such a short period of time, the benefits will probably outweigh any risks as long as vaccine trials are conducted responsibly. We know that not only is it hurting people, but straining the healthcare system, Pearl said of coronavirus. And we have a lot of people who are exposed, and it's harming the economy. When you factor all of that in, it gives you a different risk profile. In general, she said, vaccines are safe. However, she noted, the risk can vary depending on a person's circumstances. Elderly people, for example, may not have the same immune response with a vaccine as young adults have. Kazanov said that she would not hesitate to recommend vaccine for people in high-risk groups, since they are more likely to experience the most severe illness. Vaccination is worthwhile provided it only yields minor side effects, such as aches or low-grade fever, lasting only a few days, she said. Typically, I'm not the first person to prescribe a new medication, she said. I want to see it around for a while before I start giving it to my patients. I think this is going to be a little bit different, though, because the people who get so sick with it are the ones who already have so many health problems. Huang said there isn't cause of worry about vaccines, provided shortcuts aren't taken during the development of the vaccine. Health experts have said that a vaccine that skips animal trials, for example, could be dangerous. Animal trials help researchers determine whether a vaccine runs the risk of vaccine enhancement, which makes an illness worse in vaccinated individuals. We'd have to review the process, how they conducted the trial, and evaluate them, he said. But you have to make an assumption that they're doing it the way it's supposed to be done. How should the public evaluate COVID-19 vaccines? As more data and information is being released on a COVID-19 vaccine, Hwang said, he would be looking for high efficacy rates and positive test data from safety tests. He also said the public should look at what benefits of each treatment would be. We have to wait if it only had minimal benefits, but really bad side effects or something, he said. But I mean, these are assumptions. When evaluating a vaccine, Pearl said, the public should start by looking at evidence of three things: that it works in animals, that it generates an immune response in humans, and that it can prevent infection in humans. It's also important to consider the groups of people on which the vaccine is tested. If it is tested on healthy young adults, that may not inspire confidence in people in high-risk groups. It's also important, she said, to look at a vaccine's side effects. Ideally, they would be mild or rare. Everything has a side effect, Pearl said. We know there's going to be this side effect, but we want it to be rare. Or if it has a common side effect, we want it to be mild, such as with the HPV vaccine. You have a pretty sore arm, she said. The public should also look for, and even demand, that companies follow up with vaccinated individuals to ensure no long-term side effects. Health experts have said it is possible that the COVID-19 vaccine will require more than one dose, and that it may not be 100% effective. But even a vaccine that behaves like the flu vaccine, which is anywhere from 40 to 60% effective each year, would still be a big step forward in battling the pandemic. This may end up being very much like the flu vaccine, where it may not be as effective as some of these other vaccines at preventing illness in the individual, but it actually may decrease shedding enough that if we get enough of the population vaccinated, then we get that herd immunity that we really need, Pearl said. And here's the Dennis the Menace comic for today. Dennis is leaving the Wilson's house. Mr. Wilson is sitting at his table, drinking his coffee. Mrs. Wilson is waving goodbye as Dennis walks out the door. And Mr. Wilson says, "I can't imagine what he will be when he reaches his full potential." And a man and woman, husband and wife, man and significant other, or woman and significant other, are sitting at the dining room table. Woman drinking coffee, the man is holding a box of cereal. And he says, "You got me shredded wheat cereal? Couldn't you find anything with less taste?" And the woman says, "Oh, I'm sorry. Next time I'll get you okra puffs." And here's some news brief items. Moderna kicks off vaccine testing. Moderna has begun the world's largest study of a COVID-19 vaccine and remains on track to provide as many as 1 billion doses per year beginning in 2021. The Massachusetts-based biotech firm announced on Monday. The Phase 3 study is expected to involve 30,000 volunteers in collaboration with Operation Warp Speed, the federal government's scheme to end the crisis by encouraging vaccine candidates from multiple companies. Moderna is one of several companies around the world in the final stages of producing a vaccine, although none have yet proven effective among a large population. Several vaccines made by China and by Britain's Oxford University this month began smaller final stage tests. Moderna said the vaccine was done in Savannah, Georgia, the first site to get underway among more than 6 trial sites around the United States. The U.S. has more than 4.2 million confirmed cases and over 145,000 deaths. Worldwide, there have been more than 16.2 million cases and almost 650,900 deaths, according to data maintained by Johns Hopkins. The most severe emergency. 6 months after the World Health Organization declared the pandemic, The impact of the outbreak is being felt far beyond the suffering caused by the virus itself. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said, "Economies are struggling, wide swaths of people are going hungry, and essential health services have been disrupted. The pandemic is easily the most severe emergency ever declared by the agency," he said, as global cases doubled in the last 6 weeks. "As we mark 6 months," Tedros said, "the COVID-19 pandemic is illustrating that health is not a reward for development. It's the foundation of social, economic, and political stability." States hit records. A USA Today analysis of John Hopkins data through Sunday shows 13 states set weekly records for new cases, while 7 had a weekly record for deaths. New case records were set in Alaska, Colorado, Hawaii, Louisiana, Minnesota, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, New Mexico, North Dakota, Oklahoma, Wisconsin, and Wyoming. Record deaths were reported in Alabama, Idaho, Mississippi, Nevada, Oregon, South Carolina, and Texas. In Louisiana, new cases per week leaped to 15,868, up almost 45% from the state's worst week in the spring. More than 9,300 new cases were reported in Florida on Sunday, bringing the state's total to 424,000, second only to California's 450,000. Alabama worshipers infected. More than 40 people became infected after a week-long revival at a North Alabama Baptist church last week, Pastor Darrell Ross said. Two male members of Warrior Creek Mission Baptist Church in Strawberry suffered relatively serious cases. The services were shut down by Friday after an attendee tested positive with no symptoms. "The whole church has got it, just about," Ross said. "We shut down revival, and by Friday night, I've got church members sick everywhere," he said. Google workers will stay home. Technology giant Google on Monday told most of its 200,000 employees and contractors to work from home until at least next July, extending by 6 months the company's plan to keep the majority of its offices closed for the rest of 2020. The remote work order issued by Google chief executive Sundar Pichai also affects other companies owned by its corporate parent, Alphabet Incorporated, and it represents the most extensive such decision by a major corporation in response to the pandemic. Other companies are likely to follow suit. And an article from the Arizona Republic: doctors say valves in face masks are not very effective. Mask mandates are in place in cities across the country, and those orders are increasingly banning the use of masks that have valves. Though these one-way valves are designed to help provide more comfort by allowing air to escape the mask when users exhale, that function also allows the virus to spread. "It defeats the purpose," said Kaye Sabardi, a medical doctor who is the chairperson for infection prevention and control at the Mayo Clinic in Arizona. "They are unfiltered. Those valves are the path of least resistance, so to speak. It's easier to exhale and get rid of the heat and moisture. But in addition to exhaling heat and moisture," Sibardi said, "wearers are exhaling viral droplets and particles." A spokesperson for Arizona's Maricopa County, which has specified in its mask mandate that valve masks do not comply with the county's masking requirements, he wrote that the county's plan was based on the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommendation against the use of valve masks in healthcare settings. But other county mask mandates do not have specific restrictions against valve masks, and those that do have bans against valve masks don't always seem to be enforcing them. The Mayo Clinic isn't allowing patients inside if they're wearing valve masks, but Singbardi said that he has seen people wearing them before they are asked to put on a different type of mask. He said he's even seen healthcare professionals who don't work at Mayo Clinic using such masks. In a sterile field, they're absolutely banned because it allows unfiltered exhaled air in, said Christine Roman, a doctor at Camelback Dermatology and Skin Therapy, where patients who are wearing valve masks are not allowed in. A Maricopa County spokesperson wrote in an email that Maricopa County Public Health is not an enforcement agency and said that if there are unresolved issues between individuals or businesses, they are encouraged to contact their local law enforcement non-emergency number. Additionally, they are recommended further education about the masks. Roman also has seen some people wearing valve masks in public and believes people who are wearing the masks may not even realize that they may be further spreading the virus. When you look at it, you think, wow, this should be really protective, she said, but it does not decrease the transmission of COVID-19. And you're supposed to protect both the wearer and the person 6 feet away. Mask policies continue to evolve and shift as researchers learn more about the virus. But for now, Singh Bardi recommends using masks that cover both the nose and the mouth with some sort of material such as cotton cloth, and to ensure that masks fit snugly on the face to prevent the virus particles from escaping or entering. You are listening to the Ames Tribune on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and it is time for us to turn to the obituaries. This first notice is a change in service information. Daniel Reed Flannery, due to COVID-19 and the family's concern for the health and safety of the community, the visitation on Thursday, July 30th at the Cornerstone Church has been canceled. A celebration of life will be held at 11 o'clock in the morning on Friday, July 31st at the Cornerstone Church. Dan's service will be live streamed and a link will be available in his obituary on the Adams Funeral Home website. Seating in the church will be limited due to COVID-19. Face masks and social distancing will be required to help ensure the health and the safety of the community and those in attendance. A private family burial will take place in the Ames Municipal Cemetery. Next obituary is Iva M. Nielsen, age 94, of Ames. She passed away Friday, July 24th at Acura Healthcare of Ames. Due to COVID-19, no memorial service will be held at this time. Condolences may be expressed online at adamsmonument.com. Ames Monument and Cremation Center has been entrusted with the care of Iva and her family. Our next story, Black Soldiers Monument faces scrutiny amid racial reckoning. This story comes to us from the Associated Press. The white Union Army commander sits rigid atop an imposing horse. His black men, rifles to their shoulders, march resolutely alongside on their way to battle. For LaMercy Frazier, the towering bronze relief in downtown Boston captures the stirring call to arms answered by black soldiers who served in the state's famed Civil War fighting unit, which was popularized in the 1989 Oscar-winning movie Glory. But the longtime Boston artist says she understands how the imagery of Robert Gould Shaw and Massachusetts 54th Regiment Memorial can conjure mixed feelings as the nation takes another hard look at its monuments and memorials in the wake of the killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police. Whose story is being told with this monument, said Frazier, who is the education director at the nearby Museum of African American History. The hierarchy is very evident. White commander out front, black soldiers in the background. It's the first thing you see. Amid the national reckoning on racism, the Shaw Memorial is the latest and perhaps one of the more curious to receive scrutiny. Unlike other felled monuments, the work by American sculptor Augustus St. Gaudens isn't a pecan to the Confederacy. It doesn't have explicit ties to colonialism, such as the Christopher Columbus monuments that have been toppled in Boston and elsewhere. Instead, the creation of the memorial in the aftermath of the Civil War was championed by prominent black Bostonians of the day. It was originally envisioned as a traditional equestrian monument to Shaw. But the colonel's family, a wealthy Boston clan strongly opposed to slavery, requested that it also honor the black men who served and died alongside him during their famed charge on Fort Wagoner in Charleston, South Carolina in 1863. The monument is also significant because it's the nation's first honoring black soldiers, said Elizabeth Visa, executive director of the Friends of the Public Garden, a group helping pay for a $3 million restoration of the monument, which started in earnest in May. St. Gaudens spent 14 years creating a richly detailed brass relief, using black men of different ages as models for his realistic soldiers. After it was unveiled to fanfare in 1897, American author Henry James declared the work real perfection, according to the National Park Service. This was a radical piece of art, Visa said. It was not lost on people back then. The work, which sits across from the Massachusetts State House, has been vandalized over the years, mostly by people snapping off Shaw's broadsword. But during the unrest that followed Floyd's killing in May, the monument was tagged with anti-police slogans, expletives, and other graffiti, along with about a dozen others in and around the common. Kevin Peterson, founder of the New Democracy Coalition, that's calling on Boston to rename Faneuil Hall after Crispus Attucus, said the Shaw Monument should be moved to a museum because it casts blacks as subservient to whites. Similar complaints have prompted the removal of other ostensibly well-meaning monuments in recent weeks, including a statue of Theodore Roosevelt in front of the American Museum of Natural History in New York, and a statue of Abraham Lincoln depicting a freed slave kneeling at his feet in Boston. The Reverend Vernon Walker, a board member with Massachusetts Peace Action, which has called for changing the state seal's controversial depiction of a Native American man, suggests the Shaw Memorial could better recognize the achievements of the black soldiers themselves. Roughly half of the regiment's 600 soldiers were killed, wounded, captured, or presumed dead following the failed assault on Fort Wagoner, and their heroism inspired tens of thousands of black men and others to sign up for the Union Army, helping turn the tide of the war. Sergeant William Kearney became the first black man awarded the Medal of Honor for saving the regiment's flag from capture. Two sons of prominent black abolitionist Frederick Douglass, who had pushed Lincoln to allow blacks to serve in the war, also fought at Fort Wagoner. But while the names of Shaw and other fallen white commanding officers were etched in the monument from its unveiling, those of the black soldiers were not added until the 1980s, during its last major facelift. The film Glory features shots of the restored monument in its end credits. Director Edward Zwick and leading cast members, including Matthew Broderick, Denzel Washington, and Morgan Freeman, declined to comment through their representatives. For now, the Shaw Memorial is not among the public works that have come up as Boston continues to review public concerns about city monuments in the wake of the national debate on racism, according to Mark Pasnick, who chairs the city's Art Commission overseeing the process. But Visa of the Park Group doesn't think the memorial, which is expected to be restored by November, should be changed or moved. She believes people will have a greater appreciation for the work if they simply learn more about it, something her organization, the Mayor's Office, and the National Park Service have taken pains to do. Ahead of the restoration, which included dismantling parts of the memorial last week, officials hosted forums on public monuments that included prominent black scholars and civil rights activists. A temporary exhibit also has been installed on the fencing around the construction site, detailing the 54th Regiment's exploits, and a new augmented reality application, which leads people on a virtual tour of the monument where they can learn more about its significance and ongoing restoration. Frazier of the Museum of African American History says those who are all laudable steps and agrees that the monument should remain where it is. It's not enough to just see the piece. You have to go deeper, she said. There's so much not told, but the monument is so moving that it can lead you to those things if you are curious. Our next story, the House okays a bill protecting tribes' reservation. The United States House of Representatives has approved legislation that would prevent the Trump administration from rescinding a Native American tribe's contested reservation in Massachusetts. The amendment, included in a broader spending package passed by the Democratic-controlled chamber Friday, bars the Interior Department from revoking its 2015 decision to place some 300 acres of land into trust for the Mishapi Wampanoag tribe. The legislation also would prevent the agency from reversing a corresponding declaration of the lands as the tribe's sovereign reservation, where it could legally build a casino under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. In recent months, the Trump administration has used the COVID-19 pandemic as cover to try to steal the tribe's land and to find their people out of existence. United States Representative Joseph Kennedy III, a Massachusetts Democrat who sponsored the bill, said in a written statement, "This amendment will put an immediate stop to those dangerous efforts." United States Representative William Keating, a Massachusetts Democrat who also sponsored the measure, said it will limit the administration's constant efforts to undermine the tribe's rights. Keating said the issue is about people, their rights, their health, their education, and their livelihoods. In March, the Trump administration moved to undo the 2015 decision, declaring that the then-President Barack Obama's administration had no authority to put land into trust for the Mishapi Wampanoag tribe, since it only became federally recognized relatively recently. But the Cape Cod-based tribe, which traces its ancestry to the Native Americans that encountered the Pilgrims 4 centuries ago this year, challenged the decision. A federal judge in Washington, D.C. last month ordered the Interior Department to halt the revocation process, re-review the matter, and issue new findings. The tribe has more than 300 acres in the town of Mishapi and in Taunton, near the Rhode Island state line. Cedric Cromwell, the tribe's chairman, said House passage of the bill moves the tribe one step closer to ensuring its homeland is not taken away. A similar proposal passed the House in 2019, but has stalled in the Republican-controlled Senate. Our next story comes to us from the Associated Press. Polls split over a plan to exit domestic violence treaty. This story comes to us from Warsaw, Poland. Polls are bitterly divided over steps taken by the right-wing government to leave a European treaty against domestic violence, claiming it promotes gender ideology and links violence to religion. Justice Minister Zbigniew Ziobro said Monday he has formally asked the Ministry of Family to start preparations for Poland's exit from the Istanbul Convention, an initiative of the Council of Europe, the continent's leading human rights organization. It was not clear when an official withdrawal notice would be filed. Ziobro, who is head of a small group inside the ruling coalition, said he was taking the steps out of his own accord and was ready to discuss their timing with other government members. "It is time to take decisions to protect women, children, and the family against violence, but also time to give no consent to them being demoralized by norms that have been insidiously added to the valid slogans and demands for protection against domestic violence," Ziobro said on a Catholic radio, Malarja. Ziobro argued that the convention includes provisions of an ideological character that his ministry does not agree with. He insisted Poland's own legislation protects women and children against violence to an even higher degree than the convention. Council of Europe Secretary General Mazura Pejnovic-Burek has said Poland's intentions to withdraw from the convention are alarming and encouraged a constructive dialogue to clarify any misunderstandings. Leaving the Istanbul Convention would be highly regrettable and a major step backwards in the protection of women against violence in Europe, Pejnovic-Burek said Sunday. Also, the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe said Monday that Poland's move towards withdrawal from the convention were a reason for serious concern. It said the Istanbul Convention is widely recognized as the most advanced legally binding treaty to prevent and combat gender-biased violence, including martial rape, forced marriages, stalking, female genitalia mutilations, and so-called honor crimes. In Poland, critics expressed outrage on social media, saying the right-wing government of the Conservative Law and Justice Party was ready to sacrifice women's safety for its own views based on Roman Catholic traditions. Our next story, trade, technology, and security at risk in U.S.-China feud. This story comes to us from Beijing. They have the largest economies in the world. They spend more than anyone else on their militaries. From high-tech chips to control of the high seas, their interests are closely intertwined. The ongoing sharp deterioration in U.S.-China ties poses risks to both countries and the rest of the world. In the latest escalation, a U.S. consulate in Chengdu in southwestern China shuttered Monday, ordered by China to close in retaliation for the U.S. shutting down its consulate in Houston, Texas last week. With the U.S. presidential campaign heating up, all bets are that relations with China will only get worse. Here's a look at what's at stake. Both countries already have suffered heavy losses in a tariff war that erupted in 2018 over Beijing's technology ambitions and trade surplus. If talks on ending the dispute fail, the world could face downward pressure on trade at a time when the global economy is already reeling from the coronavirus pandemic. The United States is China's biggest single country export market, even after President Donald Trump imposed punitive tariffs on Chinese goods. And China is the number three market for American exporters, as well as a huge market for goods and services produced in China by U.S. companies ranging from General Motors to Burger King. Chinese purchases of American farm goods, semiconductors, and other goods declined 11% last year, but still exceeded $100 billion. Exports to China support just under 1 million American jobs, according to U.S.-China Business Council, though that was down 10% from 2017's peak. China is the biggest exporter market for Iowa and other American farm states, which were slammed when Beijing suspended imports of soybeans and raised tariffs on pork and other goods. That briefly boosted sales for soybean exporters in Brazil and Argentina, though China resumed buying lower-priced American beans under the Phase 1 trade truce signed in January. But if the two can't resolve broader differences on trade, it will be a blow not only to their exporters, but also to other Asian economies that supply China's factories with raw materials and components. U.S. and Chinese producers of telecom, computer, medical, and other technology, and their markets are tightly interwoven. Apple, Dell, Hewlett-Packard, and others rely on Chinese factories to assemble most of their smartphones, computers, and other consumer electronics. Those factories need processor chips and other components from the United States, Japan, Taiwan, and Europe. The disruption caused by moves including the Trump administration's curbs on Chinese tech giant Huawei's access to U.S. components and technology threatens to disrupt those flows and cost suppliers, including Silicon Valley companies, billions of dollars in lost revenue. China is also a top market for Apple and other U.S. tech brands, and is increasingly becoming a technology competitor with its own brands in smartphones, medical equipment, and other fields. The United States often is the top market for China's highest value-added goods. Beijing has been urging exporters to find other markets, but many say Asian and even European markets will not buy such high-value goods. While the United States has long been the predominant military power in the Pacific, China now has two operational aircraft carriers and an arsenal of missiles seen as a threat to United States vessels and bases in the region. Military tensions have largely focused on the South China Sea, a crucial waterway that is the subject of overlapping territorial claims by China and several smaller Asian nations. In 2018, a Chinese destroyer came perilously close to colliding with a U.S. destroyer, the United States ship Decatur, while executing what the Navy called an unsafe and unprofessional maneuver in the South China Sea. A Chinese fighter jet collided with the United States Navy surveillance plane in international airspace over the South China Sea in 2001, leading to a major diplomatic incident after the United States plane made an emergency landing on a Chinese island. Taiwan is another potential flashpoint. China claims the self-governing island as its territory, to be taken by force if necessary. The U.S. is bound by its own law to ensure the island has a credible defense and has approved military sales to Taiwan under President Trump. Taiwan's foreign minister said last week that Chinese military flights near the island have been taking place on a near daily basis, more frequently than previously reported. Washington upped the ante earlier this month by declaring that it did not recognize most of China's maritime claims in the South China Sea, a break with its previous policy of not taking a stance on the sovereignty disputes. And some news from around the nation. In California, Huntington Beach, hundreds of people gathered at the beach in Orange County for a religious event despite local officials' warnings. The LA Times reported several hundred people met Friday for Saturate OC, a weekly worship event. Organizers provided hand sanitizer and masks, but many participants did not wear them. Police cited Parker Green, age 34, for allegedly promoting the event without a permit. In Hartford, Connecticut, coronavirus cases among teens and young adults are rising in the state. The Hartford Courant reports nearly 40% of people diagnosed with coronavirus from July 5 to 18 were under the age of 30. In Illinois, state officials are warning of child drowning risks associated with home pools as beaches and public pools remain closed during the pandemic. Many families are using above ground or inflatable pools because of the closures. The state's fire marshal and Department of Children and Family Services have offered up several safety tips, including emptying inflatable pools right after use and storing them upside down. They also recommend installing fences around pools with self-closing and self-latching gates. In Kansas, the state is seeing the median age of people who've contracted the virus drop as the number of reported cases grows. The State Department of Health and Environment says the median age for people infected in Kansas is now 37, down from 52. On March 24th. In Kentucky, Andy Beshear, the governor, is ordering all bars to close for a second time and all restaurants to reduce seating capacity to 25% to stem the spread of the coronavirus. In Effie, Minnesota, thousands showed up for what is known as the state's largest outdoor rodeo, packing the stands for the three-day event despite orders to limit crowds because of the pandemic. In Kansas City, Missouri, health department officials in the city and its surrounding three counties are pleading with residents to follow safety precautions amid an increase in coronavirus cases that they say could lead to further shutdowns and overwhelming of hospitals. In New Jersey, more than two dozen lifeguards from two beach towns have tested positive for the coronavirus after socializing together. Officials said the lifeguards are from Harvey Cedars and Surf City. In Albuquerque, New Mexico, a Roswell physician says he will not force anyone to wear a mask at his chiropractic clinic. Dr. Karfemoeier Histov is likening the state mandate to wear face coverings because of the coronavirus outbreak to a dictatorship. In Albany, New York, the state's quest to keep voters safe from COVID-19 by letting them vote by mail in the June primary has led to big delays in tabulating results. This has raised concerns about the disenfranchisement and questions about whether there will be an even bigger mess in the fall. Election officials say it will take them until early August to finish counting a tidal wave of absentee ballots that overwhelmed a system that typically handles only about 5% of the vote. In Durham, North Carolina, only first and second year students at Duke University will be allowed to live in campus housing this fall. A school administrator said it in releasing a plan designed to prevent the spread of COVID-19. In an email to Duke faculty, Provost Sally Kumbluth said upperclassmen and graduate students will take online classes in the fall semester. In Oregon, in the quest to escape COVID-19, Oregonians are flooding the state's beaches, forests, and mountains in unprecedented numbers, according to state officials. And that's brought a spike in accidents, made campsites scarce, and brought garbage, damage, and even bears to recreational areas, especially on the Oregon coast and west of the Cascades. We're seeing a level of use well beyond the normal year, Oregon Parks and Recreation Department spokesperson Chris Havel said. In South Dakota, state epidemiologist Josh Clayton on Monday encouraged residents to redouble their individual efforts to prevent the coronavirus from spreading, in line with the governor's insistence that personal responsibility, rather than government mandates, is the best way to address the pandemic. And that brings us to the end of reading the Ames Tribune for this Tuesday, July 28th, 2020. Your reader today has been Dave Sauerman, and you have been listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Thank you for listening to our program.